You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places and all of its wit in Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Welcome to the second ever Los Angeles Pun-Off!
The punniest people of Los Angeles crowd into a Silver Lake Community Center to open what they hope will become a regular event. Think of it like a spelling bee, but with puns. It starts with a song from the soon-to-open show, Pun-Off, the musical.
People don't appreciate we're surrounded by puns every day. From the names of our entrees.
Moons over my hammy.
To the names of yachts.
The Codfather.
Breaking Bass.
A small group of friends started this up in San Francisco a few years ago. They had a one-off pun-off in L.A. a while back, but that was it. Until now. Reporter Susan Vallet was at the recent L.A. pun-off to gain a little more punderstanding.
Who amongst us has suffered the groans and eye rolls of their friends and neighbors?
You said no pun intended, but you actually did.
If I weren't holding a microphone and recorder, I'd have raised my hand. I love playing with words. That's why I do it for a living. But not all wordplay equals puns. So organizers Jonah Spear and Carmen Olson lay the ground rules.
We'll agree for now that a pun is the humorous use of a word or words.
But humorous is, of course, subjective.
In such a way as to suggest multiple meanings of a single word or the use of similar sounding words with different meanings.
Spear and Olson coached the crowd to literally practice rolling their eyes for the bad jokes to come.
And the eyes go all the way to the audience left, down, left, and then gently your head stays forward and you bring your eyes up over the top.
Then the pun-off starts off with a round of pun monologues. Carl Hansen takes the stage wearing an I Heart Pierogies shirt and cheese socks. His theme? Oscar noms.
For best actor in an eating role, we have Antonio Bananas in Pan and Glory, Joaquin Chex Mix in Coco.
Once off stage, Hansen says he loves how puns make you think quickly.
I get groaned at and laughed at, and my wife rolls her eyes at me constantly just because I tell puns all the time. So this is an opportunity to actually do it in a manner that's very receptive.
Then the Punger Games begin. There are several rounds, each with a different theme. The field starts with 8 pun masters. First round, books that have been made into movies. Some of the stories are really elaborate.
I was playing a little friendly round of golf with a friend of mine, and we decided to make it interesting to see who could hit the ball the longest. And I went up first, and I hit it and went really far. And he got up and he really gave it a knock. And when we got there, they were so close and we couldn't tell which one Godfather.
Spear and Olson sit next to the stage at a judging table. They're not judging quality, but rather whether a pun is really a pun, whether it meets the rules, or whether the pun's been used before.
So a lot of us here in LA are performers. Who's reps you? Who's your manager? Who's your publicist? Who's your agent? You know, if punning had its own category at Gersh, with all the talent in this room, there'd be some crazy rich agents.
Judge Carmen Olson holds up a banana, the pun-off's version of a yellow card or warning. Amanda Salas had used too many of the same syllables from the original wording, crazy rich Asians. Too many warnings, the use of a topic that's already been said, or running out of time gets you an apple, the red card. It means you can take a shot of whiskey or a shot of chocolate as the crowd cheers you off the stage. Amanda Salas, who's a TV reporter by day, punning queen by night, made it to the end of the final round, puns about blades.
After this category, I think I'm going to head to Blade's Pizza. Blade has been used already this round.
Whiskey or we need chocolate?
I'll have
whiskey and chocolate.
Salas says just being able to take part is worth it.
I just finished chemo 3 months ago. So this really means a lot to me. You know, brain fog, it's called chemo brain, is one of the side effects from chemo. And I was a little nervous coming out tonight because I wanted to really represent, because I call myself Punder Woman. And so coming here tonight and getting second place, I'm going to tear up again. It really just showed me that you can do everything.
Amanda Salas ends up coming in second place.
Friends, your champion, David.
The organizers present a trophy made from a random collection of junk to winner David Landau. Landau's even dressed for the part, wearing a t-shirt with a cat holding a femur and the pun, "I found this humorous."
I like that they make people think differently. I also like puns because they are one of the only types of humor that don't need to be making fun of someone.
Connie Lynn Villani of Long Beach watched all of this from the audience of about 150 people.
I'm really enjoying just the feeling of community and the feeling of like, oh, we all know this is awful in the end, but at the moment when people say it, it's super fun and you're like, oh, good job, like you went there.
And of course, the pun competitors leave me with a few public radio puns.
There was a little radio station and they were losing money and they had to fire their public relations person. And someone said, why did we have to end PR?
The organizers hope to make this a regular thing in LA and plan another pun off in a couple of months.
The annual pun off is finally here.
For KCRW, I'm Susan Vallett.
Oh, no, it happens every year, which is the definition of annual. The annual pun-off really exists. What makes people groan or moan makes us pump our fists.
It was raining cats and dogs the other day. I stepped in a poodle.
Yes! Been going for the 40th year running. Yes, competitive. Punning is a real thing, a thing for reals, that grown-ups do for fun, awkward word nerds fun.
They say a good pun is like a steak, a rare medium well done.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. You don't need me to tell you that when it comes to your screen, phone, computer, television, iPad, your cup runneth over. Every year, there are more and more scripted television series for your perusal. Last year brought 532 of them, a new record, double the number of scripted shows on screens only a decade ago. Networks, producers, and viewers are all getting swept away in the deluge as peak TV revolutionizes the television industry. Bruce Miller is a creator and showrunner and executive producer of The Handmaid's Tale for Hulu. Leslie Goldberg is West Coast TV editor for The Hollywood Reporter. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Leslie, I'm going to start with you because you're the one who covers all these shows. It must be daunting for you, crazy, trying to stay on top of what's going on.
It is incredibly challenging from my job a decade ago. Yes, absolutely.
Bruce, it's certainly different than, you know, three or four TV networks and, you know, programming Wednesday night, right?
Yes. I mean, it is interesting that it changes so much and it stays exactly the same. I mean, you still basically watch things that are basically the same length on basically the same kind of screen, except it's just exploding in terms of the number of things and how they get into your house. All those things are changing. My job, and to a certain degree, Leslie's job, you know, changes in terms of volume, but what we're doing is the same thing we've been doing for like 5,000 years.
I assume with all this work, I mean, it's a good time to be a TV writer or a producer or showrunner or anything else in the business, in the industry, right?
Oh, I mean, it's a spectacular time, and mostly because the more open space, especially in streaming, allows you to be more creative. You're not trying to get such a large cross-section of the audience, you can be a little more specific in terms of what you're doing and see if some people who have that same taste come your way.
Yeah. Leslie, I want to get back to you because we touched on the whole idea that things are different now. We know that. And streaming is the norm or becoming the norm. How do you see the streaming services really changing the TV industry?
Well, Netflix specifically, which was obviously the first streamer to hit the market, has really exploded pretty much every facet of our industry. They started with scripted. So if you remember House of Cards, that was their first original launch. And the price tag on that with Kevin Spacey and David Fincher attached was exorbitant at the time. And that had a ripple effect, and it continues to have a ripple effect on the rest of the industry. It makes the cost of intellectual property. So for Bruce, for example, The Handmaid's Tale probably drew a bidding war to land before it landed at Hulu, because every company wants these big titles that they think can draw and cut through the clutter of 500 other TV shows. And what it's done is it's had a ripple effect, not only in the price of property, but in the price for showrunners, in the price for actors, the price for directors, below the line talent, locations, billboards. And then you get into everything like, once Netflix entered the stand-up comedy space, the price tag on those went sky high. So that was the bread and butter of, say, Comedy Central and HBO. And now some of those outlets have kind of been forced out of it, or they've shifted their strategy where they can't afford $20 million for Chris Rock stand-up comedy special, which is what Netflix paid. And they bought two of them for $40 million, yeah, which at the time was unheard of. So it's basically anyone who wants to compete, who wants to draw a top talent, is going to have to pay, because Netflix has shown the willingness to pay. And when Netflix pays, it erupts the industry. So there's, you know, actors that are household names and well-known are getting offer upon offer upon offer from all over the landscape, broadcast, streaming, cable. And now that you have all these big media companies launching their own streaming platforms, the interest is even higher because the competition for those stars is even greater, because you want to have that one big tentpole show that helps define your platform.
Bruce, I want to bring you back in, because you have this deal at Hulu and MGM to create new shows. Are you worried about the competition for talent that you're going to need? I mean, are there enough writers? Are there enough showrunners and producers and actors to support, what is it, more than 500 shows a year?
No, but there will be. I mean, I'm not worried at all. I mean,
you're not.
No. I mean, I think, you know, an expanded marketplace helps everybody. And I think it's a kind of a golden age for television in lots and lots of different respects, not just in terms of quality. But the competition for talent has always been very difficult. Now, I think we're dealing with more availability issues. The expression is, you know, what's your position on this? Do we have first position or second position or third position? Do we have the rights to this actor for a certain period of time? Those schedules are getting a lot more crowded. So I think that more writers are coming into the business than ever before. TV writing is much more popular and known. I mean, I don't know that when I started, anybody knew what a showrunner was. Now everybody sends me questions on Twitter about, you know, editing decisions, because they know what my job is. So I think that, am I worried? Absolutely not. I couldn't be happier. I mean, it's great for me as a viewer, and it's great for me as a creator, and it's great for me as a reader of Leslie and those kind of people, because there's always something fascinating going on. I mean, it's hard for Leslie to put out all those stories, but it's fun for me to read them.
I'm curious about the sustainability of this model. You know, we have so many streaming services that are coming online right now, no pun intended. And you've got Disney Plus and Apple Plus and all these, you know, TV Plus, whatever it is.
Two more coming this year, HBO Max and Peacock.
And Peacock, yeah, Peacock. And so you've got all these streaming services. And I wonder, you know, at some point, the average viewer, are you going to have all of them? I mean, you know, $5 here, $10 a month here, you know, it's automatically charged to your credit card, you're not paying any attention, and then all of a sudden you're, you know, $10,000 in debt.
Is there something you want to talk to us about, Steve? How much debt are you in? How many streaming services do you have? Oh my God.
I have quite a few, Bruce, and I'm going to tell you, seriously, because the model is, give us your credit card number, we're going to keep charging you until you tell us not to.
But that's
right?
The same as HBO. HBO was an add-on too.
It was an add-on, but you got it with your cable bill, right? You had to pay your cable bill, and if you didn't, you got your cable cut off. Now everybody is—it's in charity, it's in, you know, streaming, and this is a different conversation maybe with an economist. But I mean, somebody at some point with so many streaming services, you're going to lose track with all the things that you have, and you're going to be spending a lot of money.
I think it's, I mean, and Leslie can certainly speak to this. I mean, it's the same conversation. You and I could be having a conversation of, why do we need 500 cable channels? We could be having the same conversation of, why do we need all these friggin' radio stations? You know, why do we have all these radio stations? And so, you know, I think what's going to happen, you know, if I look at my crystal ball, is, you know, exactly what you said is going to happen, is it gets unwieldy and people start bundling these services and you start selling them together. And then, you know, 20 years from now, Leslie, we're going to be talking about, oh, when Apple merged with Netflix, merged with Amazon streaming or whatever, because I think, you know, it's just cyclical. You know, now there's 6,000 different shows on 6,000 different streamers, and as either those become individually successful, like something like Shudder or something that sells, you know, a very particular kind of show, I think those Criterion Collection streaming services, those will always be have a certain audience. But I think the other ones will get bundled together, and it'll turn back into cable. I mean, it's
the streaming, the conversations for the conversations for a streaming bundle are very real, because, you know, it, to your point, there's a million different services and people can lose track. That's assuming a lot of these streaming services are going to survive. So, you know, we don't know Peacock or HBO Max or Disney Plus. Look, I mean, I pay for Amazon not because they have Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and other originals, but because I can get free shipping on all the stuff that I order all year long. The TV isn't
that's what makes
Amazon. That's what separates Amazon from the rest, is they're providing a service, and the TV stuff is an add-on. Whereas if, you know, look, you know, if you have kids, you're 100% going to pay $7 a month to watch everything Disney. And guess what? If you're married to a nerd like I am, you're going to have interest for Marvel shows and Star Wars shows. And it becomes finding the platform that's the service that's right for you and your family that has that big IP or that one hit show that you absolutely have to have. Either that, or people are just going to go back and pay $50 and buy a DVD player and buy the box set of Friends instead of paying $15 a month to watch it on HBO Max when that launches.
Leslie Goldberg of The Hollywood Reporter and writer-producer Bruce Miller, creator of The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. City Councilman Jose Huizar has been keeping mostly quiet and out of the public eye since federal agents raided his offices more than a year ago. But Huizar held a press conference yesterday. The topic? His five-year-old plan to revamp downtown's Pershing Square Park. Now, that open space, which sits right across from the Millennium Biltmore Hotel, has long been the source of criticism for its dated and user-unfriendly design. Frances Anderton hosts KCRW's Design and Architecture, and she's with us now. Hi, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
We've talked about Pershing Square before. I want to go over some of the lamenting that's gone on over the years about this park, which sits near the center of downtown LA.
Well, you just referred to it as dated and user-unfriendly. Its user unfriendliness has been the problem. The park is lifted up because of a parking garage that was put there in the 50s, so it's very inaccessible. It has barriers around it, and there's a hell of a lot of concrete. It's not an inviting park. So people have been very frustrated by it, with a burgeoning downtown.
All right. And the wheels are I guess, turning, because the city held this competition to see who was going to get the job of redesigning the park. That was, 4 years ago, right?
That's right. And it got quite a lot of fanfare. Something called Pershing Square Renew was initiated by civic activists, the architecture firm Gensler, which is in downtown, and Councilman Jose Huizar. They got seed funding from a development company, McFarlane Partners. There was a design competition. There was public outreach. And jurors selected the team that was helmed by a French landscape architecture team called Agence Terre. They teamed up with an LA firm, Salt Landscape Architects, and some other designers, engineers. Agence Terre referred to their scheme as radical flatness. The goal was to push down that underground parking garage, make the park level with the street, make it feel more open and accessible, add shade, and make it altogether a much more inviting and sort of less complicated park, to be honest.
And it stalled. Why did it stall?
Well, it stalled because it never really had the momentum underneath it. The scheme was estimated to cost $50 million. They didn't have all the money. Mayor Garcetti had never got behind this park. Jose Huizar, as you mentioned, got into political trouble with the FBI raiding his office in late 2018 in a pay-to-play probe. We should note that 15 months later, no charges have actually been filed. The Park Project became the responsibility of Parks and Recs. They focused on a more limited redesign. And yesterday's press conference was to alert people to what they are now planning to do, which is to roll out the project in phases. Phase one would simply remove the barrier walls along Olive, open up the park to the street, and add some features like more open elevators, getting people up from this parking garage below. Phase two, coming next, would remove barrier walls along Hill and turn that concrete, that hard concrete fountain area, into grass. Here's Jose Huizar at yesterday's press conference.
The spirit of the original design is being retained, but given limitations with the garage underneath the park, we are not completely going down at street level. It's going to be some areas that are street level, but some other areas where you still have a few more steps to climb up to get to because of the structural engineering. It would have been cost prohibitive to do the radical flatness, but what we have now is radical openness, which is its cousin. And so we're going to open it up and make it accessible and make it green and keep with the spirit of the original open radical flatness.
Cousin. Yes. It's all in the family, isn't it?
Well, I should say there speaks a true politician. Downgrading a project and still making it sound great. And to be honest, when you hear him talk and you hear he's going to remove those awful barriers on Hill and Olive, and you think, well, and they're going to add more grass, you think, well, perhaps this is an improvement. But it still falls far short of the grand civic vision that the radical flatness scheme was all about. And for people who've pushed for Pershing Square Renew from the outset, this is very disappointing. We talked to one of them, Donna Bajarski. She's actually been attached to the park for decades. She worked for Mayor Tom Bradley when the Legoretta project was built. She was a juror on Pershing Square Renew. And she had this to say.
Urbanists have proven that historic parks are actually even more significant for the neighborhood and for the economy than even regular parks. So this one has enormous potential, and we picked an audacious plan because we think that's what this area deserves. And I think if we lose the opportunity to make this as great as it should be, which is the full design, I think, you know, we're looking at a civic failure.
Francis, will this happen? Will something happen? And who's going to pay for it?
Something's going to happen. It probably won't reach the level of ambition of the original radical flatness design. In terms of who's paying for it, Jose Huizar has not secured federal, state or private monies for this park. Instead, he has apparently $25 million that has come from developer fees collected by the City Department of Parks and Recs. They come from the Quimby Act. That's a levy that Huizar himself expanded. And this law mandates that developers pay the city thousands of dollars per residential unit if said unit does not have enough green space. So certainly there's some improvements coming, but do they go far enough is most definitely a question that's being asked.
Stay tuned.
Yes, Steve. Yes.
Francis Anderton, host of KCRW's show DNA and a regular here on Greater LA. Francis, thank you.
You're very welcome, Steve.
Well, that's going to do it for us today. Let us know what you think. Is this a great time for television? You heard the show today. What are you watching? What are you recommending to all your friends? And how are you deciding what streaming services to sign up for? Or how many streaming services do you have? Is it confusing? It's a little crazy out there. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast, and you can share your thoughts with us there. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Next on KCRW, we're back with Frances and her show DNA, Design and Architecture. I hope you'll stay tuned for that. Later tonight, President Trump's State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress and on the eve of a decision before the United States Senate on his impeachment and perhaps removal. Coverage starts at 6 tonight of the State of the Union and impeachment coverage tomorrow on KCRW. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christine Comito, Amy Ta, and Christian Bordall make up our dream team. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and for your time. Have yourself a great Tuesday.